Reforming Police and the Bad Apples Theory. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez.
And you always have a bad apple no matter where you go. You have bad apples.
The theory has long been thrown around that there are only a few bad officers in every police department. We'll speak with a researcher of a new study that put that theory to the test. Plus, the Caribbean Heritage Museum opened in Broward County, becoming the first of its kind in the country. A discussion about Caribbean history and the diaspora communities living in South Florida. And finally, Miami Art Week kicks off, and it will be much different because of COVID-19. But why are there still so many in-person events? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Racial justice and police accountability was a critical issue in this November election, following a summer of protests that stretched from Miami to Portland to New York. Bias among police officers and the training they receive has been deeply called into question. We've often heard this expression from politicians in describing the problem with reforming police.
And you always have a bad apple no matter where you go. You have bad apples.
You can't deny that there are bad apples. Oh. And so how do you identify those
people and get them out of the force? I'd be a fool to deny they're bad apples.
We've long heard this argument, but is it true? Sociologists at the University of Miami reviewed a survey from Harvard University that measured implicit and explicit bias among millions of people from around the world. Alexis Picaro is the chair of the sociology department at UM and one of the authors on the report. He joins us now via Zoom. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Danny. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So what was it about this bad apples theory that led you to conduct this study?
Well, we were particularly interested in whether or not police officers compared to non-police officers had any higher or lower levels of implicit and explicit bias, and then whether or not those differences, if there were any, varied across race and ethnicity when we compared whites, African-Americans, and Hispanic respondents. And so the study was kind of the first one across the field of sociology, criminology, and race relations to look at this specific issue.
And was there something about the theory itself that you felt like needed to go beyond the surface level? I mean, it's like we mentioned, it's something that we've heard for years, but there hasn't been a whole lot of, digging into the weeds on this.
Yeah, it's really hard to obtain this kind of data. Many police departments are somewhat recalcitrant to let you survey the officers, especially when you're asking them about bias of any sort. But we were able to obtain this data from a more general population survey to examine whether or not individuals have these sorts of heuristic biases. And again, Danny's, all human beings have what we call heuristic shortcuts and biases. The question is, how do they manifest implicitly or explicitly, and then whether or not they act upon them? And that's a really critical question.
And can you explain a little bit to us about how this study was actually conducted?
Yeah, so individuals can log on to the Project Implicit website and take the actual tests. And so we were able to secure a sample of individuals, millions of people who participated in the survey. And then we had information on their occupation. And of course, we had information on their race and ethnicity. And then we created the categories of police and then non-police and then across race, and then analyzed the implicit bias test scores and the explicit bias test scores.
And this study, the questions were being asked by Harvard University, if I have that right?
Yeah, Harvard University, are the psychology team there about almost 20 years ago, developed the implicit bias test and the explicit bias test. And so these are long used tests. Now, of course, as you can imagine, everybody has a specific point of view about some tests are better than other tests, but it is what it is. And so we were able to secure those responses from those surveys.
And when we're talking about implicit bias or explicit bias, can you help us understand a little bit of what the difference between those two is?
Sure. Implicit bias is something that you're not necessarily conscious of what you're doing. And so you, for example, you see a particular face on a screen and then you get some words to associate with it. Good, bad, I feel warm to it, cold to it. And so these are very quick questions that are designed to get our routine responses. It's kind of like playing a video game when you and I used to go to arcades. you're doing things very, very quickly, and you're just kind of using these mental shortcuts. Explicit bias is much more intense, in your face, that requires a lot more thought. And so we're trying to measure things that are conscious and measure things that are unconscious to determine how people respond.
And what kind of questions were the respondents asked about when they were trying to determine whether bias might or might not exist?
Yeah, so they see examples of faces, and then they are asked to indicate whether or not they are warm or cold to those faces. That's an example of a kind of bias test. Others are given names of people or pictures of people and asked to indicate what their race is. So it's a series of these different kinds of tests that people use, and you're basically trying to get at how people perceive images and words and then react accordingly as a result of that.
And as a sociologist, can you help us understand a little bit about the bias that we see in our everyday lives, like at work, or if
Sure. You're
just shopping around at the supermarket? It exists not just in a vacuum of policing, obviously.
That's exactly right, Danny. And people have to remember, the listeners out there have to remember, I'm a citizen just like everybody else is. Officers have already about 20 years of living in this world before they become police officers, just like doctors, just like teachers, just like anybody in any profession. So people have been building up these attitudes and experiences all along their life course by the time they actually get into one of these occupations. So we have to be very careful to not immediately assume that these occupations somehow automatically make people biased, because people are walking around and working in their daily lives before they come to that. So heuristics and biases are, when people walk into a situation, they quickly analyze the room. When we used to walk into shopping malls, or when we go into a crowded theater, we're looking for seats, we're seeing who's around. Are there young kids there? Are there certain people here? I want to pay attention to the movie. Are there going to be loud people around me? So people are constantly using the information that's available to them to make very quick guesses. And I think a really good example of this, Danny, is when we're driving on I-95 or on US-1, and the person in front of us doesn't have their blinking light on, but you think they're going to cut in front of you, right? So we're making all of these guesses in real time without all of the information. And that's what these implicit biases are trying to get us to see, is, are we taking shortcuts about how we view other people? And in this particular study, with respect to race and ethnicity.
And you mentioned the word heuristics a couple times. Can you just help define that for us?
Yeah, so basically these are mental shortcuts. So, you know, my name is Alexis. That's my official name. When people first see that, they immediately think I'm a woman, but I'm actually a guy. And so that's a mental shortcut, is someone's name, because we've been living on this world for 18, 30 years. We hear things and we put people into groups. And that's the best way I can think about heuristics, is when you give people a name or a word or a phrase, they automatically put things into boxes, because that's how the brain picks and sorts through information. It's kind of like a filing cabinet. You're taking information and you're putting it in certain spots, and then you're drawing in from that how you might interpret a situation or how you may act in a situation. So that's what these heuristics and mental shortcuts are all about. And people do them all day long.
My brother's name is actually Alexis. I've seen people do these mental shortcuts my entire life, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Speaking about the study, what were the results of the study after you did all this analysis and you pulled apart that data and isolated it by these were the responses that were submitted by police officers?
Absolutely fascinating. What we found was that when you compared across race and ethnicity, so when you looked at whites, African-Americans, and Hispanics, whites had more implicit bias and explicit bias than any other group. That's the first finding. Then when you looked at police officers, white officers had the most implicit bias compared to Black officers or Hispanic officers. What's really interesting is the third finding, that Black officers actually had higher biases than non-officers who were Black. So we see this really interesting set of findings, that whites are using implicit bias more, first of all. White officers are using implicit bias more. That's interesting. And then you have Black officers compared to Black non-officers also reporting biases. So even among Black officers, they're using these biases when they take these tests. And so those are our principal findings. Obviously, we weren't able to see if they acted upon those biases. And that's an important finding going forward. But I think the key message of all this, Danny, is not necessarily that these biases have to prevent people from doing things. It's how people can be shown to recognize these biases. And then how can we help them change the way they view people and then not act accordingly based on incorrect or unfortunate types of biases. So I think our study is kind of saying to people, when you're screening potential applicants for police departments and any other profession, our findings are not just about policing. We've seen these findings in the medical field. We've seen these findings in the education field. The same kinds of findings open up. And so I think the key takeaway of this is when we're screening applicants for positions, you might want to have them take some tests like this just to see how they're scoring. There's not a magic number that says, okay, if you score X, you're no longer going to be in the applicant pool, but it's a piece of information that goes along with every other piece of information when we're looking at trying to select the best candidates for a position.
I'm speaking with University of Miami sociologist Alex Picardo. He and a team of researchers reviewed explicit and implicit bias data from police departments around the country and found that officers do display bias at higher rates than the public. We've included a link to the study on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Alex, you mentioned that white police officers have the highest rates of these kinds of bias. I'm curious about the definition that we're using about white officer. The definition can change across the country. You know, here in South Florida, with a majority minority population, white doesn't necessarily mean what it might mean in Wisconsin, say.
That's a absolutely spot on point, Danny. So I'm Cuban American. So my mom and dad grew up in Cuba as teenagers and came to the United States in the 1960s. And I grew up just outside of Washington, D.C. And I remember having these conversations with my mom about, well, do you see yourself as white? Do you see yourself as Hispanic? And it's one thing when we can interpret how we see ourselves, but another way when the census asks us, indicate what your race and ethnicity is. And of course, that's changed over time. Miami is a really unique area, South Florida more specifically, because it's a city of immigrants where you have individuals who identify with multiple races and multiple ethnicities. And I think going forward, what we can do as scientists, not just with respect to this particular question, but with just respect to any kind of social science issue in terms of, like, you know, we just went through a political election and dealing with COVID, is ask people how they identify themselves. And then we just code those accordingly. The way the census has worked in the past, and a lot of researchers in the past, it's actually just forced onto people. You have to select a box. I think we have to move beyond that and allow people to kind of select how they see themselves and then start analyzing those data accordingly.
Given what we know about the history of racist actions taken by law enforcement, do the results of this study at all surprise you about what you found?
I don't think they were as surprising as I imagined they may have turned out to be. Again, you know, we were starting from a position of we don't know what the data look like. And I don't know if Black officers have any more or less bias than non-Black officers do, or Blacks who are not police officers. So in one sense, I'm like, okay, well, so this does give some credence to people who believe certain things. But it's not a one-for-one in the sense that we don't know if people are acting on those biases. And that's the critical question. So police departments actually can use training programs where they are survey the officers with these tests, and then they give them scenarios with 3D videos or other kinds of techniques where they actually carry out decisions in a context. So you can vary the race of the suspect, the race of the officer in this kind of virtual training, and then you can give the results to the officers themselves and have them go, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. So I think what this is good for is it's more of an educative tool and potentially more of a preventative tool going forward, because I think all of us, I'm a citizen too, all of us want a good, fair policing department. And the police also want good, fair citizens to work with. It's not a one-way street. Police communities have to work together to solve local problems. And 21st century policing, Danny, is built on trust and legitimacy. And that goes both sides. The citizens have to do their part and the police have to do their part. And I think when you do that well, you have good outcomes.
So a few months ago, we spoke with Broward County Sheriff Gregory Tony about the issue of bias among police officers. And this is what he had to say.
Look, we are entrusted with something very special in this country, and that's the public's trust. They have agreed under a social contract that they will respect law enforcement, that we would be under the perception that the people that are wearing this badge is of good moral standing and would not violate the laws that they've sworn to protect. And so if we get to a point where we have a few individuals who violate those trusts, violate the laws, then they should be held accountable and they should be removed from this profession.
So Sheriff Tony acknowledges that bias does exist and officers are receiving training for it. But is that enough to regulate officer behavior?
It's really hard to regulate the behavior of every single person and ensure that people will not enter the profession and or act in ways that we do not want them to act. So there's no foolproof way of creating a mechanism where you will never hire someone who doesn't have a tendency to act in a certain way. I'm not saying that to be pessimistic. I'm saying that to be realistic. When you're dealing with thousands of officers, and this is true, Danny, in every profession. It's true in medicine. It's true among lawyers. It's true among airline pilots. It's true in every profession. The key is you try to do the best you can at selecting people at the outset. You do the best you can at training. And the training is not just a one spot on when these people are in the academy. It's like a booster shot, I call it. Every year you have to go through training. You know, as an academic, every year I have to go through training as a faculty member for various kinds of policies. I think you have to continue to remind people of these things and continue to build as diverse of a workforce as you possibly can. And you just continue to try and prove to be a better department every single day. And that's as much as you can ask any department to do, because you're not going to be in a situation in any profession to ever solve the problem of bias. Again, if we're gonna deal with this problem, we need to deal with the fact that these people have been on the earth for 20 or 30 years. So the biases that they are an adult with are already occurring when they're children and when they're adolescents. So that's where we have to address these problems at the in educational systems and at home as early as possible.
And as a researcher, is there any way that you want to kind of follow up with this research that you've done to any questions that are still left unanswered that you're curious about?
Yeah, you know, any kind of good research question yields a bunch more. And that's why academics always tell you we need more research, right? And so your listeners probably don't want to hear that line again. But yeah, the answer is yes. One of them in particular you actually raise is how do individuals who respond to these tests, how do they then act upon them? So I think we need to link the attitudes towards the behavior. That's one set of studies. And another one that you raise is, well, we have this definition of white that might be true in some parts of the country, but not true in other parts of the country. And the same thing is true with Hispanic and African-American versus Black. I think we need to do a lot more digging into the details about these issues and how people see themselves and then how other people see them. I'm reminded of an actual thing that happened to me about a dozen years ago, 15 years ago. I actually was on a racial profiling study here in the city of Miami. And I was late coming to the meeting downtown because my flight got delayed, and I walk into the room and the community is around, community members around, police officers around, study teams around. And someone said, oh, everybody on the panel is white. And I raised my hand and said, well, I'm not white, even though I look white. And so I think you have this issue about people's perceptions, and people are going to perceive what they're going to perceive. I think what we have to get people to do is how do we get them to recognize the way they're perceiving may not be the ideal situation. And then hopefully to have them not act in nefarious ways on them. I think that's what we want to do, is to make sure that if people have these biases, that we can do the best we can to correct them, but most importantly, that we try to do everything we can to let them not act out in real time.
I've been speaking with Alex Picaro, chair of the sociology department at University of Miami, and one of the authors on the report. You can read the report on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Alex, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Take care.
Still to come, the first Caribbean Heritage Museum in the country opens in Broward County. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. The Caribbean community from across the country now has a home in Broward County with the Island Space Caribbean Museum. Here in South Florida, we have museums and spaces dedicated to Haitian, Cuban, and Bahamian cultures separately. But this new museum is the first of its kind to bring together different Caribbean nations and cultures under one roof. Kalib Thompson is the museum's co-founder and executive director. She joins us now. Thanks for joining us, Kalib.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
I'm doing great. So from the Dutch islands of the Southern Caribbean to the French, English, and Spanish-speaking islands, the Caribbean is kind of known as a notoriously vibrant region. Why was it important to you to unite all these different cultures and countries under one Caribbean heritage for this museum?
You know, one of our advisory board members is a woman by the name of Dr. Claire Nelson. She's the person who is responsible for getting June designated as Caribbean American Heritage Month. She said to me, there is no Caribbean country. You know, conceptually it exists, but there is no Caribbean until you set foot in South Florida or in New York or one of these places where we kind of all come and congregate. Because when I was growing up in Jamaica, I would hear about the Caribbean, but I only knew Jamaican people and maybe one or two Trinidadians or what have you. When I came here to live in South Florida, this became the real, you know, the Caribbean is a melting pot in terms of all these cultures that exist there. But to know these people and to eat their food and to listen to their music, this here in South Florida, New York, and Atlanta, these are the true melting pots. And while we do kind of hang out in each other's spaces, it was important to me, and it's been important to this community for so long. I've been hearing that something like this was coming, and it's just never come, you know, that we really acknowledge each other and how special we are to each other and how much of a family we are as a Caribbean community here in South Florida, where one out of four people who live here was born in the Caribbean.
It's an interesting thought. I think of the phrase you that some people see the look at the trees and they miss the forest. And maybe if you grow up on an island, you might see the tree, but you're missing the whole landscape that creates the region. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So how did the pandemic affect the work that you do in creating this museum? You're opening a museum at a really precarious time for a lot of cultural institutions.
Yeah. Our situation is it's a little funny. We've taken maybe 3 or 4 years to become an overnight success, so to speak. We have been, myself and my business partner in our for-profit business, David I. Muir, have been working on these cultural projects together for many years. And we've been doing pop-up museums that have Caribbean culinary items. We've been on with Lewis before to talk about these things. And, you know, I produce a national television series called The Islands, where it's this, you know, travel and culinary series that explores all these Caribbean themes. And we have been funded by grants and by, you know, private donations and what have you. And because of COVID, a situation, we have been doing this culinary event each year for the past 3 years. And the situation arose where we couldn't do it this year. And we had grant funds allocated to some of our cultural activities. And I won't get into the details, but one thing led to another. The space became available thanks to our friends at Westfield Mall. The grant funds were available and, you know, we were permitted to reallocate them thanks to our friends at the Community Foundation of Broward. And things fell into place such that we could start the project, you know, where we've been able to start it at the Westfield Broward Mall. It's still in a soft opening phase. We are slowly allowing people in. We are observing, you know, social distancing and mask wearing and what have you. But the circumstances of the world, you know, allowed the resources to be moved from one cultural activity to where we are now.
And can you walk me through some of the things that someone can expect if they show up to the museum, they walk in the doors? What kind of things are they going to see?
So our welcome area, the very first area when you walk in, of course, has a nice festive carnival dressed mannequin. So you feel festive once you get inside. In our first area, you're going to see a panel of a wall full of panels that describe all of the various islands of the Caribbean. And because we want people to feel like they're connected to their own homes, you'll see the board that talks about Jamaica in English, of course, but in the board that talks about Haiti is written in Creole. The ones that talk about Puerto Rico are in Spanish, etc. So people feel connected to where they're coming from. In the archive, which is the historical heritage kind of element, we're telling the full story of the Caribbean region. So it's not an island by island thing. You're going to learn about the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean. You'll learn about colonialism all the way through plantation life and slavery and emancipation. You'll learn about our evolved identities and how our governments and economies and so forth were formed. And then the things that we're all popular for, which is our, you know, traditions, the religion, the carnivals and festivals, the folklore, the arts and entertainment, so our music, our sports, our television and film. And then the final area in that heritage piece talks about the Caribbean American connection. So, you know, we know about people like Kamala Harris, who's in the news right now. Her father's Jamaican. But how many people knew that Shirley Chisholm, who was the first black woman to run for Congress and get in there, she was the first woman to run for president, I believe. Her parents were Guyanese and Barbadian. Did everyone know that Alexander Hamilton was actually born on the island of Nevis and not in the U.S.? So there's so much to learn. And as your previous guest said, you know, the more you learn, the more you want to learn. And that's what we hope happens inside of this space. We also have an art gallery and small event spaces that people can use for small, socially distant gatherings. But it really is a multi-purpose space that belongs to the community we represent and the broader community that we want to invite to come in and learn about who we are.
So at the museum, you showcase the diversity of these cultures through things like music and language. How is that different than other museums?
I don't know that it's different. I know that we do things our way. And so you're coming in. I remember the Sun Sentinel had done an article on us, and someone said, you know, why is this at the Broward Mall? Why isn't it in a tin shack? And I think every museum or every institution has its own personality. We want to be, we're coming from countries that are often classified as third world. We've created this space so that it feels first world. We've looked at the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., as well as, you know, our friends at History Fort Lauderdale, for example, or Arlick in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and seen how they have articulated the stories they're telling and kind of brought all of that together. So we tell our story in a way that both connects with the past, but does it in a way that is very appealing to, you know, a diverse cross-section of the people who will visit. And, you know, the question was always, how are you going to pull all of the Caribbean together to fit inside of, you know, 1,500 square foot archive space that you have to kind of rejigger to maximize what you've been given by the mall without changing it too much. And we've done a really good job with it. It's very slick. It's very attractive. It's all bite-sized information. We use multiple screens and, you know, interactive elements so that you really can immerse yourself in what you're seeing and interacting with in this space.
I'm speaking with Kalib Thompson. She's the Island Space Caribbean Museum's co-founder and executive director. The museum is the first of its kind to create one unified space for the heritage and common traditions shared by Caribbean islands and nations. You can find more information about the museum and how you can visit on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Kalib, I'm curious, the items that you're collecting and the things that you actually have on display, it's my understanding that you're actually soliciting items from the community itself here in South Florida and collecting them that way. How does that process work?
I'll tell you a funny story. The way that we got started was I went to my mother's home in Jamaica and pilfered all of the collectibles that she had, that she was collecting from when she was younger, when her grandparents were on a farm in the country and what have you. And I packed them all up in suitcases and barrels and I shipped them up here. And that's how we started with our culinary museum. And so in building this out, it really has been a call to the Trinidadians and the Cubans and the, you know, the Antiguans and the people from Montserrat and Guyana. We do touch on the mainland as well. Anywhere that's touched by the Caribbean Sea is a part of this family that we're creating. And who tells a more authentic story than the people from that place? So we've been putting calls out for items, whether they be culinary or domestic or things from your own family's history. And in doing the research on a place like the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., we learned that Lonnie Bunch, who was the founder there, did put out a call to African-American households across the country when he was pulling that together. And they've ended up with thousands and thousands of wonderful items that really are from people's home and people's own family histories that weave together to tell the story that they're telling. And so I'm stepping along in great footsteps is what we're trying to do here.
How have the events of this year influence how you curate the museum, like from the COVID-19 pandemic to the social justice movement that really gained momentum over this last year?
I'm going to turn that around a little bit. We really have not allowed that the circumstances of now to affect how we're curating, because we're controlling the narrative of the story that we're telling, and it is meant to celebrate our diversity, to build tolerance. One of the things that has come out of this year that we've all noticed is this, this intolerance for people who are other than, or people who are immigrants. And everyone represented inside of that space is an immigrant, and many of us are proud American citizens right now. And, you know, the more you learn about other people or other cultures, is the more tolerant you become, the more you begin to accept and understand that there's so much more that we have in common than, you know, what separates us. And so even in our doing the culinary museum, that's a thing that we would find as we toured Broward County and stopped at this library or this museum or this cultural center. People would come in and say, oh, you know, whether they were from Russia or from South America, or whatever, they would come in and say, oh, my grandmother had one of these, or I remember seeing this in Africa, or what have you. So, you know, we don't want the outside to determine what we're doing. Of course, we're going to celebrate, as I said, people like Kamala Harris because she's in the moment. But we want to be influential to the outside world rather than having it be the other way. And I do want to just point out, if anyone has items that they would like to donate, I'm going to ask you to visit islandspacefl.org. There is a donation page for items, and of course dollars if you'd like to donate the dollars. But you know, we really want to have everyone represented, and that's what we're about, start to finish.
And we'll definitely put that out as well. I am curious about how, because the Caribbean is kind of it's a region, and it doesn't have hard definitions. So I'm just curious, when you're thinking about the Caribbean and how to put it into one narrative. I mean, like you mentioned, the Caribbean is also Guyana, Venezuela, Panama is a big thing because these places are not islands, it's not often included in the narrative. I'm curious how you're thinking about that in approaching this museum.
Very carefully, because of the fact that the brands that we have been developing over years typically have the word island in it, And as we have been developing this project, we'll find that people from Guyana or Belize or Honduras or wherever, you know, they'll come and say, we are a part of the Caribbean as well. And so we don't want to exclude anyone. And so our position on this is evolving almost daily. We want to be as inclusive as possible. So there are even places that we didn't think about as including in this project at the beginning that we have come to include as we move along. So again, any island touched by the Caribbean Sea? I don't believe that the Bahamas is technically part of the Caribbean.
I don't think technically, you know.
Yeah, but they are certainly in our within our family there in the museum. So that evolves daily.
I want to thank our guest, Kalib Thompson. She's the Island Space Caribbean Museum's co-founder and executive director. Kalib, many thanks for coming on.
All right, have a good one.
Thank you. Still to come, what will Miami Art Week look like in the middle of a pandemic? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Danny Rivero, filling in for Luis Hernandez. Miami Art Week has officially started, but this time it's fundamentally different than years past. Normally, thousands of art lovers descend on South Florida for events like the main event, Art Basel. Basel decided to go virtual this year because of the pandemic, but a number of in-person art events will still go on. Joining us now is Brett Sokol. He's a contributing writer on arts and culture for the New York Times. Brett, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So I want you to take a journey with me to what feels like a millennia ago to last December. What would have been happening in a normal year at this time of the year?
A lot of people sort of half-jokingly call Art Basel the Super Bowl of the contemporary art world, but that's not really that far off. The Art Basel Fair itself, and it's important to distinguish that from everything that falls under the umbrella of Miami Art Week. The Art Basel Fair takes place every December at the Miami Beach Convention Center, and it is a convergence of a who's who of the contemporary art world, not just collectors and the dealers that are selling artwork to them, but curators, museum professionals. Really, it's a very unique gathering of the contemporary art world in thousands and thousands. And because of that critical mass of art world people, all of these other events sprung up, it seems like more and more every year, to try to draw some of that crowd. I mean, we now have, there were something like 36 satellite fairs last December around Miami and also Palm Beach and Broward County as well. Galleries, in addition to the galleries that are already here, there are pop-up galleries that come into town just for that week. There's a dizzying array of dinners and special events and all kinds of product launches that sometimes seem to have very little to actually do with the art world. It's the art circus comes to town. And obviously, that's very, very different this year because Art Basel, as well as almost all of the major satellite fairs, announced back in September that because of the pandemic, they are going virtual. They were not going to be doing in-person events in Miami.
And how large of a boost on a typical year does Art Basel and all these surrounding fairs and events for Miami Art Week, how large of a boost does that have on the South Florida cultural economy in normal times?
Well, there's the immediate dollars and cents number, and then there's the larger cultural impact, which in some ways is even more powerful. Most serious estimates put the economic impact at about $13 million. If you talk to people from the Chamber of Commerce, they'd like to add additional zeros to that, but I think $13 million is a pretty safe number. But beyond that, there's what Art Basel did for Miami's homegrown art scene. I mean, it really put it on the international map, which isn't to say that there wasn't amazing talent in Miami before, long before Art Basel came to town. There always was. What changed is that Art Basel helped create an art market in the sense of it sparked a whole new generation of collectors who then began looking seriously at buying artwork by emerging Miami artists. And it also put Miami artists on the radar of a lot of other collectors all around the world, from New York to London to Hong Kong, who also, again, started looking very seriously at Miami artists and buying their work. And that had a fundamental effect on everything in the Miami art scene, not just, Miami's and galleries, but most fundamentally, that so many Miami artists who before that basically really couldn't make a living as an artist per se. They, were a teacher or a professor or they worked as an art handler. And on the side, they made their art. It wasn't something they could actually live off of. That changed in a fundamental way, not for everybody, but certainly for a greater number of Miami artists than had ever existed before. And that's really attributable to the Art Basel factor. Although I will say that, a lot of people have also complained that in recent years, so much of the focus of Art Basel has really been on everything but Miami artists. And so some of those effects are being diminished.
Right. And then this year, without the main fair and without a lot of these satellite fairs, I'm curious, is there a sense that the things that are going on is the lens kind of focusing more on local artists rather than these international artists that might come from Hong Kong or somewhere else?
Well, sure, just by default, because so many of the exhibitions that are happening are featuring homegrown talent, that puts the spotlight on Miami artists. They're not being crowded off stage, as it were. I mean, that, again, is one of the things that, that happened in recent years, is that so many of these collectors who were coming to town for Art Basel to look at art here, they were going to New York-based galleries that set up in Miami and looking at New York artists and going to events set up by other New York art folks. And you had a lot of Miami artists saying, what's going on? There's this huge amount of activity unfolding in our backyard, and we're like the kids pressed up against the window looking inside. So I think there's a lot of hope on a lot of people in the Miami art scene that if there's any kind of silver lining to this year's event, it's that Miami artists themselves can take center stage.
And the people are still coming into town, is my understanding, right? It's not that, that people from New York, say, have, are just across the board saying they're not going to come down. A lot of people are still coming down. Do we have any idea how many people might be making that kind of trip?
You know, that's a really good question, and we don't know for sure. I think there's two things going on. The first part is there are an awful lot of people from the Northeast who are here already. They, you know, the Hamptons crowd, as it were, that spent the summer, fleeing from Manhattan to the Hamptons, and they're very involved in the art scene there. A lot of those same folks are down here in South Florida for the season. And a lot of the in-person exhibitions that have opened up are counting on a lot of those folks to show up, to look at art, and hopefully to buy art. Most of the people that I spoke with weren't really counting on too many people actually flying into Miami for the event because, again, there's a pandemic on. That just seems a little crazy. I have to say, there's a disturbing number of people who don't seem to be taking the virus that seriously, and some of them are coming in. If you look on Instagram right now, you see an awful lot of folks posting pictures that they're in their private jets. They're heading from Miami. So, we'll see how this plays out.
So these events are generally packed with thousands of people in enclosed spaces. You need to keep art within certain conditions. And more than likely that's, you know, especially if it's a painting or something, it needs to be inside. How much of Art Week has to be kept at specific temperatures? I'm sorry. How is all this happening when COVID cases are reaching higher than ever, certainly in other parts of the country, but we're also seeing an increase in cases down here?
Right. Well, I understand your confusion that a lot of people are looking at this and scratching their heads right now. I think the first thing is to say those big tented events are not happening. Most of the museums that are open, the galleries that are open, places that are doing in-person events, they have announced they're all following safety protocols. People have to wear masks to enter. They have to remain socially distanced. And that they're putting in crowd controls. For example, I know that the Perez Art Museum, who have a brand new exhibition that's open that's focusing on African and African-American artists, they've said that they're operating at 20% capacity because of that. They're limiting the number of people that can come through at any one time. That said, all around the country, cities with the same positivity rate in terms of the virus, or sometimes not even as serious as Miami, they're closing their museums. They're closing events. And it's worth reminding ourselves that in Miami-Dade County, over 50 people died last week from COVID. There's, you know, as we talk right now, there's over 600 people in the hospital because of COVID. Over 13,000 new infections happened last week alone in Miami-Dade County. So this is something that needs to be taken very, very seriously by everybody.
I'm speaking with Brett Sokol. He's a contributing writer on arts and culture for the New York Times. We're discussing how Miami Art Week is happening this year under COVID-19 protocols and the impact of a Basel-list event. You can read Brett's story in the New York Times by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Brett, from your understanding, the local governments here, right, the Miami-Dade County, the cities involved, the city of Miami Beach, the city of Miami, are all of them giving kind of the blessing to let these things go on, or is it kind of hands off?
Well,
loaded question, I know.
Miami, there's the law as it exists on paper, and then there's what actually plays out and what happens, and that's as true with politics as it's true for this Miami Art Week. The laws all over the place. Things are very chaotic. I mean, for example, in the city of Miami Beach, you have a mayor who's taking this virus very, very seriously. And yet we have a governor in the state of Florida who seems to be acting as if all of this is very overblown. We've got a countywide curfew in place for midnight to try to limit the kind of late night events that are generally credited to spreading the virus. And yet we've got a mayor in the city of Miami who said he refuses to enforce the curfew. So what that means is that things are very, very chaotic on the ground, depending upon where you might be. And it really becomes incumbent for everybody to take action themselves to protect not only themselves, but everybody around them. I don't think we can really rely on local laws to safeguard the public health at this point. It's just too chaotic.
We've heard from a number of different artists over the past several months about the impact of this pandemic and what it's had on them, both emotionally and financially. This is DJ Carrington, who's been behind the local project Commissioner that allows individuals to become investors in the South Florida art scene.
Artists are people first. So I would say that it's not because they're alone or in quarantine per se that they may also be feeling creative. They may have not had access to their studios, and artists have different kinds of creative practices. I mean, a visual artist who has had access to a studio and their fabricators may be able to continue creating. It's time for us and for our neighbors, if we're able, to consider thinking about how we are supporting our creative economy.
So, Brett, do you see Miami's ecosystem for artists coming out to support those in need right now, or are they kind of falling through the cracks? And where does this, you know, which is usually the centerpiece for the South Florida art scene, where does it fit in?
Well, you know, I think DJ makes a really good point. I mean, this is a very large ecosystem in terms of the art world, and it's not just about the artist actually selling the work in the galleries. I think one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough is that here in Miami, most artists still, I mean, we have a number of artists who are making a living off their artwork, but that's still not the majority. Most artists really make ends meet by working as part of what they call the gig economy. They're art handlers, they're art installers, they're working behind the scenes at the museums and the galleries around South Florida. And they also make art, and they, you know, those are part-time gigs for most of them. They're not full-time employees. They don't have healthcare benefits from a lot of these jobs. And when the pandemic hit, and galleries and museums closed down, and art sales really froze, you know, these were the people who were really impacted in a major way. I mean, their incomes just disappeared. And so that's, you know, how do we address that? I don't have an easy answer for you. I think that's something where there's going to have to be a lot more assistance, not just from the local art ecosystem, but something on a national level. Are people stepping up? Absolutely. I'll give you an example. Oolite Arts, they have something they call the Ellies Awards, where they give out grants every year to artists here in our backyard to work on new projects. Previous year, they gave an Ellie Award to three artists. This most recent go-around, because they saw how many artists were taking it on the chin because their jobs had evaporated, they gave that award to more than two dozen artists, and they were substantial awards. They ranged between $5,000 and $40,000, and that's the kind of financial support that really makes a difference in an artist's life in terms of being able to create, you know, an exciting new project, really put the time and care into it that it needs, and then bring it to the public. So I think, you know, institutions here in Greater Miami are definitely, they are stepping up. I mean, the Knight Foundation, the George Perez Family Foundation, the county, they did give grants to also institutions, different museums, but it's certainly not going to be enough. They're, you know, if you're talking about really making people whole or helping them get through this, I think there really would need to be something at a much higher level.
So quickly, so every year during Miami Art Week, there's a couple iconic moments. Like last year, I'm thinking about the infamous banana exhibition at Art Basel proper. Quickly, because we have to go, do we know what that moment might be this time around?
You know, I think for me, again, it comes back to Miami artists. getting their turn in the spotlight, both in terms of gallery shows. There's two absolutely fantastic painters who have a show at Spinello Projects right now, Reginald O'Neill and Jared McGriff. They're both painters that really show what Miami can do. And then there's also something called the AIM Biennial Art in Movement, which has been put together by the local artist William Cordova with some other curators around town. And that is outdoors, so it's certainly much, much safer for people to see the art. And it features 69 artists who are mostly from Miami, putting art in all different types of locations, very far-flung locations all around Greater Miami.
Thank you.
And it really shows what Miami can do. Their website is aimbiennials.org, and there's a map there that shows where everybody can go and actually see the art. Thank you, Brett.
Brett Sokol is a contributing writer on arts and culture for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us, Brett.